Open your Bibles and turn on your brains. It's time for the Think Theism Podcast.
Can the existence of God be demonstrated?
I'm convinced that there are better arguments for theism than for atheism.
Meaning universe is not epistemically unlikely given theism.
Any contradiction between the existence of evil and God's being holy, good, and omniscient.
Now, if you study a well-made banana...
But that we evolved by a rather laborious... combination of random mutation.
One can't sensibly be both a naturalist and accept evolution.
The biggest difference, of course, winds up being who is Jesus and what role does he have?
This will be the roadmap that we go through. We're going to talk first about just the background in general of what we mean by the New Testament, what we mean by reliable, and why it matters. Then we're going to cover three areas of evidence, being heavily weighted on manuscript evidence. These last two we'll kick off more for later. So just to orient us when we're talking about the New Testament, a lot of times people have this view that the New Testament is a single work or a single document that was put together by one author. If you accept divine inspiration, in a certain sense that's true, but not exactly what we mean in this context. So the other reason that it's relevant is because some of your arguments, or some of the arguments that I'll be discussing today, are relevant for some books, but they're not relevant for other books. So when we're talking about the New Testament, we have five books of history, the four Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles, and then a smorgasbord of epistles, you know, general letters, some of them written by Paul, some of them written by other people, and then whatever the heck John was doing on Patmos. That's kind of the second category. But the reason that this is important is obviously if you're talking about historical evidence, that isn't necessarily going to be relevant for the reliability of James, since James has almost no contact with history. And also, when we talk about manuscript evidence, it's important to note that some of those manuscripts, or if you can imagine that if you say you have a lot of manuscripts of James, but not a lot of manuscripts of the historical documents, you have to be honest in presenting that data. So all of this is to say that when we discuss the New Testament, even though I'm treating it as a collected whole, it's important to remember that there are merely 27 or so books that have a label given to them, more like a library, if you will. All right. The other thing to keep in mind is the time that they were written, because they weren't all written exactly at once. And that's also relevant because of the events that they describe, too, the gap that's between them. So this is more or less a rough timeline. 30-33 AD, there's a big fight over that, whenever Jesus ended his ministry. Paul starts writing his first epistles about 20 years later in 50 AD. He writes up through, I think, 65 was whenever he died. 70 AD is a very important date. Oh, 60 AD is, this is the earliest proposed date for the writing of Mark, I believe. And then 70 AD, you have a lot of events going on. The Jerusalem is sacked. The temple is destroyed. Judaism, as we know it, as it was known at the time, was completely more or less killed at this point in time. And this is, if you look in the peer-reviewed literature, the scholarly consensus for whenever Mark was first written was 70 AD. It's kind of the agreed-upon date. And then 80 AD is whenever you have Matthew and Luke being written, and then 90 to 180 or so is whenever the book of Revelation is typically thought to be written. So I'm just going to average all that together and use 70 AD. So keep that in mind. If someone says, when was the New Testament written, 70 AD is an average of everything. So about 40 years after the end of Jesus' ministry. Okay. So, discussion question. Why does it matter if the New Testament is reliable?
Does it matter?
Yeah, or does it?
Foundation of your entire argument. It's kind of where you're either building from or working to. So it's not reliable, it kind of undermines your entire credibility.
Sure. You're good.
If the New Testament's not reliable, then we might as well throw away every single history book that we have.
Ooh. I like reading.
The historical attestation of the New Testament is far exceeds any other historical work, the works of Plato, anything else that we actually have.
Okay. Any other? Nick, go ahead.
The New Testament's unreliable. I'm not sure why I'm here or even a Christian.
Yeah, Paul would agree. So this is like the standard right here. Paul says if Christ is not raised, then you're worthless and you're in your sins. So clearly, if the central event, if the very central event that Paul says the whole thing hangs on, if that's in doubt, then pretty much everything else is in doubt. So that's sometimes the reliability of the New Testament is a little bit related to historical Jesus studies. For that reason. Yeah, go ahead.
If we're talking about like the reliability of like the physically like written New Testament, like how could you argue if you said that Paul's letters were written before Matthew, Mark, Luke, John's Gospels? Like how could this quote be referring to that if they're not written down at the time? Like, okay. I know they're referring to Jesus' life, but
sure. So the very good point. You're calling me out on some equivocation. The point here is, I'm kind of collapsing my argument. The central point of, I don't think I went over it. Basically, the New Testament makes these claims right here, and these are very important claims that you can find in pretty much all of Paul's letters, and most substantially in the Gospels as well. Jesus is the Son of God. That's kind of the big deal. And that Jesus died to take the punishment for sins. That's kind of, those two statements is basically all of Christianity, as well as rising from the dead. So like those two or three things are kind of all of Christianity in summarize. So if those claims are unreliable, then our faith is unreliable. That's what Paul's arguing. But what I'm arguing is the way that we access these claims is through what we call the New Testament. So if our means of accessing the claims are unreliable, then our knowledge of the claims are also unreliable, which means that we can't have either certainty or reasonable certainty about what we believe. So it's actually a really good question. I've given this same presentation for like 6 or 7 semesters, and no one has ever called me out on that, on that equivocation between Paul and the New Testament there.
I'll make a habit of it.
All right, that's good. I like it. Okay, so that's basically where we're going with this. Now, this is where I give my disclosures. I'm an evidentialist. So the reason that's important is that this presentation and the arguments that we cover are completely presupposing that entire framework. If you try to take these arguments and say, look, this demonstrates with 100% certainty that the Bible is without error, it's infallible, it's from the Word of God, from the very mind of God, that's not going to work. These arguments are not strong enough to do that. You would need to use different arguments, and those are arguments that are non-evidential arguments, going back to the presuppositional evidential divide. But like you mentioned earlier, though, even if you are a presuppositionalist, it's important to be aware that these are here, that they exist. Just you need to make sure you don't put too much weight on something that isn't strong enough. So that's the whole point there. All right. So now the question of reliability. We're answering two questions. First, do we have what the authors originally wrote? Do we actually know what they wrote? And then the second one is, the things that they wrote, were they actually true? So for the first question, that covers manuscript evidence. And then the second question, historical reliability, that's where we cover things like internal evidence, external evidence, archaeology, all that fun stuff. So we'll start with the first question and get into some manuscript evidence. And I'm going to read this quote, and then I'm going to ask you to just give like an initial reply, if you will. The general foil for our conversation is Bart Ehrman. He's been one of the most vocal, critics of the reliability of the New Testament. He is a textual scholar from Duke University and converted from evangelical Christianity, and he's now an agnostic. And he's made a lot of money writing books with these incendiary titles on them. So this is his central claim behind misquoting Jesus. He says right here, we don't have the originals that were written by the New Testament authors. In fact, we don't even have copies of the originals or copies of the original. What we have are copies made much, much later. And in many instances, they're copies made many centuries later. And these copies all differ from one another in many thousands of places. So that's kind of the central thing. So, initial response. You don't actually have what you have, or what you pick up in your hotel room, the little Gideon Bible. That's not the New Testament. That's copies of copies of copies of copies going all the way back. Any initial responses?
This is why we should believe the Quran instead.
Yes. Okay. Go ahead.
No, I think I don't want to spoil it.
No, okay. I appreciate that. Okay. So the answer is actually to say yes, that's right. We don't have the original copies, or the original autographs is the technical term for that. And it actually is true that the way that the New Testament was written is that largely the church in Palestine started writing letters and things like that, incidental letters according to their customs, which then spread to multiple areas throughout the empire. And as people started reading these letters and reading what the apostles were writing down, they thought, oh, that's kind of interesting, I want a copy too. So they started making copies themselves. And then their friends said, ooh, I want a copy too, can I have your copy? And they said, no, but I'll lend it to you so you can make a copy. And they do this and do this. And it's what's called uncontrolled transmission, where there's not some governing body that says, yes, this is the authoritative text. It was mostly just, you know, Christians copying on, as incidentally, I guess would be the term there. And the effect of that is you end up with these different text types. I won't bore you with the details, although it is very interesting. That depending on the geography from where these text types are, the variation between it has ended up, you get kind of these traditions, textual traditions that are a little bit different from each other. So the Western text is going to be a little bit different from the Byzantine text, which is going to be a lot different from the Alexandrian text. And that just had to deal with, you know, the natural evolution of the text as it was copied. But this is actually really valuable to know that it's geographically diverse. We'll come back to that in a minute. But the two central rules, though, because it doesn't really matter if they're copies, right? What matters is, are they actually correct and are they accurate? You know, that's what the real question is. And that's what the entire field of textual criticism is about, which I don't claim to be an expert in that. So everything following here, asterisk for that. The two basic rules, which, oh my goodness, this is super simplifying. In general, if you have more copies of something, and if you have early copies of that same something, you can be much more confident in your reconstruction. If you only have a single copy, let's say that there was some book written in, 150 BC, and you have a single copy from 1400 AD, how confident are you in your reconstruction there? Not very. There's no telling what has changed and what hasn't. So the number of copies is a good thing, because whenever you have multiple witnesses that you can compare, you can see just how much it actually has changed over the time, over that time period. And obviously, the earlier you can go back, the better that is. And to kind of orient us, this is a horribly out-of-date table of different roughly contemporary works, where you have, and a lot of these are actually major historical works from where we get the majority of what we call Roman history today. But if you see, these are all written roughly 500 BC to about 500 AD or so. I think they only go up to 100 AD. But you see here that the time span between the copies is roughly 1,000 years in the neighborhood. So you got 750 for Pliny the Younger, and you got 1600 for Catullus. And you see that the number of copies here doesn't really go much higher than one or two orders of magnitude. So you got 200 for Demosthenes or so. But the idea is that 200 and 1,000 years is about what you're expecting for these types of works. Does anyone know what spoiler, outside of the New Testament, do you know which document is the single best textually attested document? Yes.
Isn't it the
Annals
by Tacitus?
I think that's the best historical one, but this is all Greek, historical or ahistorical.
Okay.
No. That one was written. That's a Sumerian text from several long time ago, BC.
We can barely translate.
Yeah, that's true. All right. So it's actually the Iliad. Yes. The Iliad is the best one. There are about 2,000 manuscripts, and the time distance is about 400 years. And this is outside of the New Testament. This is the best, attested thing. Yeah, go ahead.
Question about that chart. Do you know when it says the earliest copy, if that means, any fragment? Because when we do, P52, that's, one tiny
Yeah.
Counting things like that, or is this full?
Honestly, I don't really put a lot of stock in this chart. It's from 1979. All it should do is just give you a general idea of the averages is what you're looking at. Yeah.
One question I guess I had was with the manuscripts, especially from the New Testament, what process goes into dating the manuscript?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question too. So carbon dating is involved. You can do that with certain manuscripts. There are also the type of manuscript that it is. So if it's papyrus, people know that that's before, like that's before I think 500 AD is the hard line on that. If it's made from, I can't pronounce it, I think it's velorum or valerum, valerian, no, I'm just kidding. Vellum, there we go, yeah, vellum. That was a practice instituted, I think, like in 700 AD or something like that. So there are certain things like that. There are also textual clues as well. But like if it's in lowercase or if it's in uppercase, things like that.
Handwriting is a big deal.
Yeah.
That's how they get real accurate ones.
True.
When they try to narrow it down within 50 years or so, it's handwriting.
Yeah. All right. So what does the New Testament look like? We have roughly 5,800 Greek manuscripts. That includes little scraps and that includes big books. And that's from the Münster Institute in Germany, as well as 18,000 translations. And this is something that's really interesting. It's really hard to get an estimate on this, but the early church fathers quoted the New Testament extensively in their sermons. And there's roughly 36,000 to a million citations of the New Testament, just from people like Polycarp and, you know, those guys in the first 100 years. And there's this fellow that did this project called E. Quintana, and he reconstructed, I think, like 60% of the New Testament just from patristic citations. And it's not even close to exhaustive. So if you want to look that up, that's there. I thought it was really interesting. Anyway. Here are the most important ones, though. So these are the complete collections of the New Testament. And I think all of these contain the Septuagint as well. So Sinaiticus and Vaticanus are easily the top two most important. And as you can see, these are, you know, in that 300 to 400 AD range. So we're seeing that this is comparable to the Iliad. The Iliad was about 400 years. This one's about 350 or so. And these have the entire thing. In addition to that, we have little scraps. This is probably the single most important scrap. This is P52, which was dated to, I think it's 125 is like the date that it's set. This is the single oldest scrap in existence. And this is kind of exaggerating it. It's really only about this big. It's not that big. The reason this is important, though, is because leading up to its discovery, I think in 1940 was whenever it was published, the majority of the late 1800s in critical German scholarship had dated the Gospel of John to, I think, 250 AD, like written way, way after the first century, second century, deep into the third century. And then this came up, and whenever it was dated to 125, it kind of, you know, completely upended all of that speculation by saying, you know, here's a single piece of evidence that completely outweighs all of your literary speculation. And I think that that's kind of an interesting commentary on, you know, speculation. But what does all this mean? So this is what it looks like. Whenever you take those little P52 type scraps and you got all the other ones, you get about 44% of the New Testament between our start date of 70 AD, that's kind of our cut, up to about 350 or so AD. So you get 44% pretty well attested with the scraps. Then in 350 AD, you get all of your big codices and important stuff. And then after that, you get lots and lots and lots of really good manuscripts, mostly from the Renaissance era. So what does that mean, though? Whenever you have a bunch of different things like this, or whenever you have a lot of copies, the downside is that you end up with a lot of variations between them. But the latest estimate, about 500,000 non-spelling differences between the different manuscripts. So if you have one that has a certain reading, another one's going to have a different reading. There are 500,000 of those. By comparison, does anyone know how many Greek words there are in the New Testament?
It's less than that.
By several factors, yes. There are only about 150,000 words in the entire New Testament. So 150,000 words versus 500,000 variants is a really big disparity.
In fact, that's what Ehrman mentions later in that same quote. He says that these copies differ from one another in so many places we don't even know how many differences there are. And he's right. There's no way to actually know. They're just estimates. And he said it's best to put it in comparative terms. There are more differences among our manuscripts than there are words in the New Testament. That's spicy. Yes. All right. So what should be the question that we need to ask, though? Go ahead, Nick.
Frankly, what are the differences? Are we talking about just the...
Exactly. Not all variations are created the same. So here's a nice little categorization. You have whether it's significant, as in does it change the meaning of the text? And then you have is it viable, as in could it actually... be the original wording. And what you find out is you end up with a lot of these spelling variations, which I mentioned earlier. The 500,000 actually doesn't include spelling, but stuff like this where it's ridiculous. Obviously not the original. And even if it were the original, it doesn't really change exactly the point here. You have some that are significant but ridiculous. So there's one here, 1 Thessalonians 2:7. Is it, we became gentle among you, we became little children among you, or we became horses among you? So clearly the horses one is not viable. And then you have some that actually are viable but are insignificant. So in the genealogies, is it that Jesse the father of David or Jesse the father of David the king? Those are not the same thing. And it could go either one, but it doesn't really deeply change what's going on. But then you have this scary section, things that change the meaning of the text, and there's uncertainty about what the original is. So this is probably the single strongest example, and everything else is really not that significant. But in Hebrews 2:9, it says that Christ died, or so that Christ would die apart from God, that he might taste death for everyone, or does he die by the grace of God, so that he might taste death for everyone? Those have two very different theological meanings, depending on how you take that. But what's the point, though, is that these are my own personal estimates, asterisk here. The overwhelming majority of variants fall in either insignificant or not viable. They just don't really affect the meaning of the text. Usually it's word order things, or it's not spelling differences, but alternative wordings of things. That small percentage, which, what's 1% of 500,000, though?
Isn't this a greater number than...
Do what?
That's including the not viable, not significant, which 500,000 wasn't.
The 500,000 is non-spelling variants. So I cheated on this one because I put a spelling variant. But that's non-spelling, is the 500,000 number that you're looking at. But of this 500,000, about whatever 1% of 500,000, 5,000?
Yeah.
5,000 of those will change the meaning of the text and could actually be original. But the thing is that even whenever you're talking about things that are significant, significant is kind of a subjective thought. Like Hebrews 2:9, like I said, probably is the single most contested textual variant. And honestly, I don't think that it's, I personally don't find it as significant as some people may. And everything else is considered to be less significant than that. But the takeaway here is just that you have a lot of variants, but most of them are insignificant. That's the takeaway. And
most of the significant.
Wow, let's not do biology. Let's not do that. Yeah. Actually, yeah. So, summary: because of the geographical diversity of the New Testament, there's no like single funnel point. It's very difficult for the church to in mass rewrite the New Testament. And because we have these long lines of textual traditions that go pretty early back, at least to within 300 years, we can actually reasonably reconstruct the original text at least as reasonably as we can any other contemporary document. But probably the biggest thing here is that these textual variants don't actually affect any of the core like central doctrines that have defined Orthodox Christianity. Over the centuries. Perhaps a better way to put this would be, it doesn't matter which text type you pick, you can defend, you know, the Trinity, the divinity of Christ, the resurrection, justification by faith. You can defend all of those things using any one of those texts.
So you don't actually leave with different conclusions. You may just have a different set of proof texts, if you will. So you may use a verse from John over here, but you may use a verse from Ephesians to make the same point. And that's kind of the general takeaway with that. I'm not even going to do this. Just read fast if you want. I will make this point, though. Archaeology is probably the most abused form of apologetics. Just because you find a rock that has Jesus on it does not prove the Trinity. It doesn't do that. So here, I'll just leave you this one nugget because this makes me angry. So the purpose of archaeology is to show that the writers of this document understood the context that they were in, the political, geographic context. And that's best explained that they were actually a part of that context. So one of the common retorts is, you know, if I have a book of Spider-Man and I match up all the areas in New York, that proves Spider-Man is real, right? No, but it does show that the author of the Spider-Man comic book was probably from New York and understood that region very well. So that's kind of the takeaway there. So a parallel example would be that Luke accurately understands the geography of the Mediterranean Sea, just as well as Stanley understands New York. So we'll just close right here with this. Ehrman himself, at the very end of his book, actually says, despite all those textual variations, despite all of the hubbub about all that, he says, the position I argue for does not actually stand at odds with the position that the essential Christian beliefs are not affected by textual variants in the manuscript tradition of the New Testament. And that's where we'll leave it. So, boom, done. Think Theism is a production of Ratio Christi at Texas A&M University. Our producers are Ben Hellyer, Andrew Robbins, and Zach Lawson. Ratio Christi meets every week, and we'd love to meet you too. Please go to thinktheism.org to see our upcoming schedule as well as previous episodes.